So we're back from lunch.
We're back from lunch.
What'd you have for lunch?
Oh, I had some leftover Chinese food. What did you have?
Yeah, I had a bagel with cheese on it.
Bagel. What kind of cheese? What kind of bagel?
It was camembert cheese. And it was just like a basic ass Trader Joe's bagel.
Basic Trader Joe's.
One of my hottest food takes within the food community is that I don't really care where my bagels come from. All bagels are kind of fine.
That is just patently not true, though. That's just not true.
No, all bagels are fine.
Jamie, they're fine. The difference between a bagel from your local bagel bakery shop is a world of difference from like a Thomas's bagel that you get in the six pack at the grocery store freezer section.
Yeah, but I just don't care that much.
So you don't care about flavor or texture?
I know. As a New York Jew, I should have a really firmly held opinion on this.
We're just like someone who's up their own ass about food.
That's correct.
But you don't care.
I just can't muster it for this one. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
I'm going to adjust the timing on that because that was perfect on my end. And you cocked it up. But it is a podcast about movies and wine. I'm glad you've turned it around. I'm glad you agree. I'm glad you stopped being contentious for no reason and that you can accept what the audience and frankly, Jamie, if we're being truthful with each other, what the metrics are telling us the last few weeks.
Listen, man. I don't do it just to be contentious. I also do it for yucks.
But you derive your yucks from agitating me.
That, I mean, yeah.
Right.
Over the last 25 years, this has been a theme.
Right. And that agitation comes from you being contentious willfully.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. Now, I'm not any better than you. I'm the exact same way. But like, let's call it what it is. All right. Let's just call it what it is, Jamie.
We both get pleasure from bothering the other, which is probably a thing that we should be discussing with our therapists.
Well, you discuss it with your therapist. I'm going to discuss it with this glass of wine right here.
That sounds extremely healthy. So for those of you out there who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, that's wine and movies. My name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
My name is Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we, James and I, are here to help you. Normally, each episode, we would pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
Also, normally, we would tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't. Today we're doing something a little bit different. Welcome everyone to part 3 of our miniseries, Pinot Grigio versus The Matrix Resurrections, or They Took Your Story, something that meant so much to people like me and turned it into Pinot Grigio.
That's right. That might be... It's not my favorite of our blank check style, inserting the name of the wine into a line of dialogue from the movie. I think my favorite is the tortured one from the Christina Ricci marketing person. But I do really like that one.
God, shout out to Christina Ricci in this movie.
Yeah. All 30 seconds of screen time. And she just tells you everything you need to know about that character with her like stone lifeless face.
It's so good.
Yeah.
She might as well be just a horrible marketing person in real life.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell that, I don't know. I don't want to read too deeply into something that's right there on the surface, but maybe Lana Wachowski has had some very unpleasant dealings with marketing people at movie studios.
Maybe, possibly at a specific movie studio.
Very, very likely. But yeah, so thank you for coming along with us on this continuing and bizarre and somewhat arbitrary journey, drawing maybe there's parallels between Pinot Grigio and 2021's The Matrix Resurrections, the fourth film in the Matrix series, as directed and co-written by Lana Wachowski.
Today, we're diving into Domaine Chauffit Pinot Gris Tradition, which is available at b-21.com for $26.
Yes. And on my side of things, we will be looking at Resurrections in the context of legacy sequels, sequels to long dormant franchises that are being resurrected for one reason or another, nostalgia pornography, and what that movie has to say about this trend and how it kind of fits into this like trend in this conversation that these movies seem to be having with each other.
Scott, are you taking anything for that cough? That one sounded really bad. You got some Robitussin handy?
I've got a tube of horse paste in the bathroom that I'm going to go chug after we're done here. So Jamie, let's just get into it. First thing, we talked about it a little bit last time. We have thus far in this miniseries been drinking what I understood to be Pinot Grigio.
Correct.
But this is a Pinot Grige.
Pinot Gris.
Pinot Gris, G-R-I-S, I apologize.
G-R-I-S, the right. S is silent because it is en français.
Ah, oui. But so you have said that Pinot Gris and Pinot Grigio are synonyms, but that they're actually also not, that there's like a difference between them?
When they are labeled Pinot Gris versus Pinot Grigio, they tend to connote a style difference. The Pinot Grigio style, first and foremost, comes from Italy. It is the aforementioned Santa Margherita, super neutral, you know, drink until you black out type style. And it also is the skin contact Ramado / orange wine style. Pinot Gris tends to be a more French lens on things. It's also what tends to get labeled in the United States and also in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia and New Zealand. It tends to be a little bit riper, a little bit more aromatic, sometimes with a little residual sugar and also sometimes with botrytis influence.
Okay. So it's the same grape, but made differently.
Correct.
Okay. I understand. Thank you for breaking it down like a fraction.
You got it.
So this is our first Pinot Gris of the miniseries. A little preview. Are there any more Pinot Gris coming up, or are they all going to be Grigios?
Actually, from here on in, we're talking exclusively about Pinot Gris.
So we're sticking in France for the rest of it. I don't know if you've noticed this, but I clearly have not retained the wine minutiae of our miniseries plan that you've provided me with.
No, this is the only French wine that we're going to be talking about, and then the final three wines are characteristically for me from the United States.
All righty, cool.
Let's start with what you thought about this wine, Scotty, because you texted me last night. A characteristically vague, like, whoa, this show feet.
Well, I'm trying to save it, Jamie. I'm trying to save it for the show.
Want me to know that you have thoughts about
it. Yeah. Well, because it's like, it's presenting less strikingly weird and funky to me now than it was last night. But like, it was a little provocative last night. Right off on the nose, I was getting saline and fucking dreaded grapefruit. Does that ring true to you?
I think there's grapefruit in this wine sure.
But not a note of salination on the nose?
Rather than salinity, I would say what I've said I definitely said this about Schioppetto, the like Parmesan rind.
Okay, note. Yeah, the umami savory thing going on.
Right.
I get that, but I'm also on the nose definitely like Parmesan on the palate. I agree. I concur. I'm adding that to my notes. That was my idea originally, and I didn't just absorb it now that you've said it. But so on the nose, definitely getting saline still getting it. Feeling confident that there's some seawater stank on this wine.
That was my next question. So you say saline, you mean specifically the ocean?
Yeah, I should be clear. I don't mean clinical saline. I mean ocean water.
It sounds like you mean like dirty ocean water.
Yeah, you know what? I wasn't thinking that, but I was picturing the brownish, brackish ocean water from the fishing beach that I used to live near, that we used to go to, because we lived in Rehoboth and it was a touristy town. But if you went to this fishing beach like 10 miles up from the main Rehoboth Beach drag, like the water was brown and ugly and there were fucking horseshoe crabs all over the place, but no tourists. It was very peaceful and quiet. But it was, yeah, that is the smell that I'm getting.
Okay. I love that you've got a sense memory thing going on.
Yeah, f*** you. I do have a sense memory thing going on.
What else you got?
Well, first, just the look of it. I can't decide if it's a pale yellow or a medium straw. Help me settle this.
I'd say medium straw.
Medium straw? Okay.
Yeah, but there's definite, like, we talked about with the Scarbolo, how the whole thing was copper. There's a hint of copper to this wine as well.
Like around the edges of the glass, maybe?
Yeah.
Interesting. Why? This is not a wine thing. This is more of a physics thing. I need to talk to a physics person. Why the light is refracting differently at the edge of the glass than just looking straight on?
Yeah, that's a thing that I've wanted to dive into, because that like rim variation definitely exists. You know, whenever I'm blind tasting a thing, particularly with, let's say, Malbec tends to be like really dark purple at the center and then almost like neon pink at the rim. And it kind of gives itself away even before you start nosing and tasting it.
Hmm. Do we know any physicists who might have like an idea about why the light and water refraction is different in that way?
I bet you if we posed this question to Adam, he would do the necessary research.
All right. Let's make a mental note. I will reach out to Adam and see if he has like an even halfway educated opinion on it. Maybe I'll try and get him on mic.
Anyway, yes. So...
So body, medium body, not mega viscous, not super thin. Would you say medium body? Yes.
Yep.
Tannin. There is some kind of astringency here. I know it's not tannins because it's not red, but there is an astringency. Wait, hang on. Shut up. It's called.
You're almost there. You're right at the finish line.
It's gone. I had two glasses of wine already today. Jamie, shut up. It's gone.
Lightweight.
Drunk.
Fair on both counts. Yep. It's phenolic bitterness. Phenolic bitterness is the phrase you were looking for.
And there is that in this.
For sure. Pinot Gris / Grigio is a famously phenolic grape, and it's one of the ways that you can identify it. That sort of like pinching, biting bitterness on the back corners of your tongue.
On the old palate, is there a nuttiness? Tani thought she was getting almonds. I didn't, or maybe she said pistachios. I don't remember. But like she had a specific nut in mind. I just have like nuttiness ? Written down. Does that track?
I think it verges into nuttiness. Nuttiness can, you know, for people in the trade can make us think about oxidation. And I don't think that that's here. For me, this is almost like green almonds. Have you ever had green almonds?
Probably, but I don't remember them.
So they have that sort of characteristic smell of almonds. But they also, when you eat them, they're very tart. They're the immature, unripe form of almonds, and they tend to be sliced down real thin and used as a garnish on dishes. This for me has that to it.
I was getting some flavor notes in the ballpark of saline to match my nose, the palate confirming nose. There is that bitter finish. I guess that's the phenolic bitterness that you're talking about. Again, on the palate, just like with the Scarbolo, I was getting sort of ill-defined citrus notes that I couldn't place. Smelled like grapefruit, but not tasting like grapefruit. Is it grapefruit? Am I detecting grapefruit?
I think there's grapefruit here.
Fucking grapefruit.
It's delicious.
Your experience is not the same as mine. Once again, the very specific note of Starburst is coming back. And I think this time, maybe I'm getting orange Starburst notes.
I dig that. Yeah, orange Starburst for sure.
There is a burn in the back of the throat that with like the combined between the burn and that weird nuttiness thing that I was getting something in the ballpark of cardamom, like a hint of cardamom.
A little spice.
Yeah.
That burn also, I think, certainly because of elevated alcohol here. We're at 14.3%.
Oh boy.
Yep. It's a big one.
So this is only 1.3% more than our previous wine. Than the Scarbolo, which was 13%.
Right.
So like, all right, don't give it to me mathematically because I just said it's 1.3%. But like in terms of perception of alcohol and getting you drunkness, does 1.3% make that big of a difference? Because you didn't say the last one was a big boy.
Yeah. Well, I think very clearly it does. You know, you're talking about a burn here, but let's talk about the range that wines typically live in. You know, you're talking about a range from like 8 or more commonly 9% up to 16%. It's a very small range, but a wine at 9% alcohol doesn't feel like much at all. And a wine at 16% feels like a booze bomb. And similarly for beer, you know, like a Yingling Lager is, I think, 4.5% alcohol or 5%. But if you graduate to... what is it? Yards Pale Ale at 6.5%. It feels much, much heavier.
That feels unintuitive to me. That the small percentage difference, you know, that just doesn't make a lot of sense. Like it makes sense to me that the difference between a 13.5% glass of wine and, you know, 80 proof, like, glass of whiskey that like those two things are going to taste and burn very differently. And one is going to get you much drunker, but I don't know. If there was a duplicate of me, if Nega Scott was here and he had the same, you know, negligible tolerance that I do, and we both sat down and started having glasses and, you know, if all things being equal in terms of diet and whatever and fucking fat content, because he's a lazy ass just like I am. But like if he started with this wine and I started with the Scarbolo, like would he get drunk faster than me?
Yep. Consider the percentages, the range for blood alcohol content that measure the difference between being buzzed and being dead. We're talking about tenths of a percentage point. 0.4% BAC is dead, whereas 0.1 is drunk.
Huh.
And that's a tenth of a percentage point.
Well, that's 0.3 of a percentage point.
Measured in tenths of a percentage point, ass.
I'm just saying, man. Do the math, baby.
So it makes sense, given our sensitivity to alcohol, that our perception might be a little bit fine-tuned.
Well, thank you for joining me on that narrative cul-de-sac there.
And a reminder that alcohol is poison, so our body is trained to detect it.
Yeah, that's why our body is not happy. Our body is saying, hey, what the hell is wrong with you? Stop drinking this shit all the time, Jamie.
Your body is saying that to my body?
Well, I think my body is saying, oh my God, stop hanging out with Jamie. I can't deal with all these mornings after. All right, so Jamie, tell me things.
Not yet, because you've told me like intellectually what your notes are on this wine, but you didn't talk about whether you like it or not.
I mean, is that really even interesting, Jamie? Isn't that the least interesting thing that we can have as a conversation is whether or not we like something?
That was a really funny bit of sarcasm that you did.
I'm not joking. In truth, you know, like the most boring conversation that I have in a movie theater lobby after a movie is over is everybody goes around and says whether or not they liked it. That can only be the beginning place, right? Like, how did you feel about it? What did you like about it? What didn't you like? What do you think it's about?
Well, that's the thing. You start with, did you like it? And then you finish with, what about it resonated with you?
Well, I start with the flavor notes as organized in my tasting journal here. And then I guess, all right, fine. I don't know if I like it. It's weird.
You said you found it, what was the word you used? Not compelling.
It's complexing. It was not at all what I expected. It was the first of the two bottles that I opened last night because I forgot which one we were pairing with which episode, but I knew I had to drink both of them in advance last night. I found it very complexing. Don't dislike it. Don't like it. It's just not at all what I expected from a Pinot Grigio. It was like it was funkier and more aggressive than I really thought I would be getting out of the glass.
And that's the story of Alsace and sort of the model there is just increased ripeness, a little bit of botrytis influence. You know, you said you find it complexing. I'm guessing you don't 100% know where you land.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I feel like I've been pretty clear about that. I'm really not sure how I feel about it, though I will keep drinking it.
Interesting.
What is the, we say botrytis a lot. This is one of those words that I'm supposed to remember, but then I never do, which is convenient for you because then you get to keep explaining things to me, which is your favorite. But of all the things that I'm tasting and smelling, what of that is a result of the botrytis?
So just brief refresher, botrytis cinerea is a fungus that can infect grapes as they ripen, particularly towards the later, more wet parts of the season. And it can drain liquid out of the grapes to create a more concentrated flavor, and then also to bring its own particular flavor to the mix. The things that are indicators of botrytis typically are honey, ginger, saffron, honeysuckle, and like a spicy character. I think cardamom is the one that you got.
So the weirdo, unexpected cardamom note, that's my botrytis.
Yes.
How do we spell botrytis?
B-O-T-R-Y-T-I-S.
That can't possibly be correct.
Well, it's Latin.
Well, whatever, Jamie. I didn't really hear you speaking it in a dead language, did I?
It's a genus and species name, Botrytis cinerea.
Right, because science, because it's all still Latin.
That's correct.
Old world, Jamie. You're hanging on to the old world.
I am, and I don't want to, but so much of our vocabulary is dependent on that colonial bullshit.
You're a colonizer, Jamie. You are an intellectual wine colonizer.
I know. I don't deny it.
Well, as long as we're speaking the true, then that's what's most important to me.
We are speaking the true.
All right, so why this wine? Why are we talking about this wine? What do you like about it? What tickles you about this here bottle of Pinot Gris.
I think all of the things that you find complexing and confusing about this wine are the things that I really like about it. I like that it is a more powerful, higher alcohol, more textural, and more aromatic Pinot Gris than the ones we've encountered. It's almost as though you take this grape and you turn the volume up. I find all of that really compelling. I also really like full-bodied white wines. Like in my personal taste, I tend towards fuller-bodied whites and lighter-bodied reds. And that's just generally the world in which I live. And this is firmly like a fuller-bodied white wine. I love the way Botrytis expresses itself in this wine. I think there's a lot of that like sweet honey and ginger character here. I like your cardamom call a lot. But I think there's a lot more fruit than you described also. There's a lot of like really ripe McIntosh apple and Bartlett pear. Grapefruit is almost like ruby red grapefruit juice. It's just like really kind of bombastic in its fruit character. Yeah, shocking no one. I like a thing that is loud and announces itself.
Yeah. We're all here just gripped by the fucking third act reveal that Jamie likes things that are loud and announce themselves when they walk into a room.
Much like myself.
Yeah, I believe that was my point. Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't getting a ton of fruit. Maybe it was just all the Botrytis funk weirdness that was kind of masking it. But yeah, it was all that weird stuff that I got front and center.
There's a lot of technique on this wine. There's the Botrytis. There's a lot of, they use old oak barrels to give it a little bit more development so that it's not quite so like shut down and mineral the way the Schioppetto was.
Oh, the old oak. So is that there's a like a malolactic thing going on?
No, it's called micro-oxygenation.
So I'm not getting creaminess or butteriness?
You're getting creaminess, but not butteriness. Okay. The creaminess from the lees contact.
Right, which I definitely remember what that is, and you do not need to repeat it again because we're already going long. Please continue.
Us go long? Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, let's get into why I chose this wine.
Yeah.
A thing that I noticed as we were beginning this recording, which I guess I should have noticed prior to it, is the last three wines that we discussed are all like second or third generation winemaking families. These aren't huge legacy families that have been in their particular areas for centuries. They're relatively new and they were able to purchase vineyards and vines in like mid 20th century when land was cheap. I think that's sort of an interesting parallel between the three that we've got and the different expressions that each gives and the different focus that each family has had. The particular focus of the Chauffite family has been specifically the areas around Colmar, which is a city in the south of Alsace. Colmar is famous largely because it's the home of one of the greatest Grand Cru vineyards of Alsace, which is called Rangen de Thann, or just sometimes referred to as Rangen.
Rangen de Thann?
Rangen de D-E Thann, T-H-A-N-N.
And is that somebody's name or is there a translation available?
That's the name of the vineyard. It is so named because I really don't know. Rangen is the farthest south Grand Cru vineyard in Alsace. It's also the largest. One of the things about Domaine Chauffite that I find really compelling is their focus on reimagining abandoned places. You have these places within this Grand Cru vineyard that had been completely abandoned because they couldn't be farmed by machine. The vineyard was far, far too steep to get any machines up into the vineyard. And so people in the beginning part of the 20th century just stopped making wine from those places because they didn't think that it was economically viable.
Right, because now everything was going towards modernization and you use the cheapest tools available. And so they stopped going to the less accessible fields.
Exactly. And this is, you know, as the pendulum swings, right? This is then what happens next, where we sort of reclaim these lost places and find that there's immense value in them. I think it's telling that this bottle is more expensive than the Scarbolo because it is harder to farm the vines where this came from.
And are they making less than Scarbolo was?
For sure.
Because they're not on the valley floor, and so they're producing less fruit.
We're talking about very steep vineyards in granite soil. Yields are extremely low.
Well, hang on, Jamie. I don't want to stop you dead in your tracks, but granite is a rock and not a soil type.
It is both.
I don't understand.
So granite decomposes into smaller pieces of granite. And those smaller pieces of granite can become laden with biological components that are necessary for soil. And so the soil type can, in fact, be granite.
Pro-con of growing in granite soil. Why would we do it? Why would we want to avoid it? Is this a T-word thing? Does it mean that I'm tasting those rocks in the glass?
It's a little bit of a T-word thing.
I'm going to taste those rocks, Jamie.
You're not tasting the literal rocks. You're not having mineral uptake by the vines. But the particular hydrology of these sites does have an influence on the chemical makeup of the grapes later on and on fermentation byproducts later on as well.
I don't know, Jamie. I think I can taste granite in this wine. I just had a sip. I'm definitely not a little bit drunk and susceptible to suggestion. And I think I'm definitely licking some rocks here in this glass.
Listen, I think that there's a big mineral component to this wine also. Aha! And I would describe it as dusty granite also, but that doesn't mean that there's literal granite in this glass.
Then where did the flavor come from, Jamie?
Scott, we've done this.
I'm just saying, Jamie's has no room in this conversation. Get Jamie's the fuck out of here. I'm tasting rocks there. Therefore, there are rocks in my glass.
Oh, boy.
See, this is that playful, delightful, contentious back and forth that everyone just keeps tuning in for every week. This is really the heart of the matter. This is the good stuff.
Where you use my words against me in a way that demonstrates that you don't fully understand what I said.
Right. But also that, yeah. Yes, that is correct. Yeah. In the first episode, I nitpicked all of your choices, and now, three full glasses of wine later, I am just going to interrupt you and antagonize all of your word choices for funsies.
So to answer the question that you posed to me, I don't know, yesterday.
I don't think I asked any questions.
Which was pros or cons about growing in granite.
Oh, yes. Many moons ago.
The pros are, in granite soils, they're very well drained. You don't have to deal with much disease pressure. They also are not overly fertile, so you don't have to worry about overcropping or controlling for, you know, higher vigor vines. And you get very, very concentrated fruit from that type of soil. Cons are you make less wine because there are fewer clusters on each vine.
All right. That was concise and adequately answered. And I just wish you were able to get to the point sooner.
I wish that too, Scott.
It would be better for us all. The listener wishes as well. People are looking for their skip 30 seconds button.
Yes. So I'm going to move through some of the other points that I had about this wine a little bit quicker because they are definitely retreads of places we have been.
Okay.
We've talked about old vines.
Indeed.
Right? A bunch. And we're going to talk about old vines more. Right. But one of the reasons why Bernard Chauffit wanted to explore these areas that had been abandoned was that they still contained old vines, 70 plus year old vines that were still alive, but just hadn't been tended to.
Okay. So these are old vines, but these are not like old pre-phylloxera vines. They're just regular old.
Pre-phylloxera vines basically don't exist in France.
Right.
France got completely fucked by phylloxera.
They got phylloxed.
They got fully phylloxed. That was bad. That was really fucking bad.
No, that was good. I think you can have that. I think you should bring that to the next summation meeting of the minds and spread the word. And you guys should let everyone know about phylloxing, a new verb
I'm
that
I've coined.
I'm
terrified that they would actually like that.
It's not bad. It's not terrible. Good. No, it's not good, but it's kind of fun. it's like in fucking Argo, the Ben Affleck movie that won Oscars for reasons. Did you see Argo?
I did not.
There's just this like running joke in the movie between John Goodman and Affleck and Alan Arkin where they're like, Argo, fuck yourselves, because the title of the fake movie that they're producing to trick the Iranians into thinking that they're not actually like a secret CIA rescue team sneaking into Tehran to free the American hostages. You know, this all actually happened. Is that they're making like a goofy sci-fi movie called Argo. And they just repeatedly say, Argo, fuck yourselves. And it's not good, but like, you know, a good actor could sell it. So like, I don't know, Jamie, give it to the Salmation crew. Like, I'm sure there's an Alan Arkin or a John Goodman amongst them who can really make it happen. It's not you, they're obviously. You're doubting too much.
I am doubting. Maybe Phylox, hashtag Phylox is going to make it onto the Instagram trending.
For sure. 100%. That hashtag is going to take the fuck off.
With three X's in it. Ay, ay, ay.
Well, now it's a whole other thing. Now it's like the porn parody of the great Phylox.
Right. Now it's plague. Sexy.
Yeah. It was definitely not sexy before.
So no, these are not pre-Phyloxed vines. They're 70 plus years old. But they're very compelling and they produce really, really concentrated fruit. And it was the impetus for beginning this domain where they began it. The opportunity to work with places that had been abandoned and vines that had been untended. And I very much identify with that particular spirit. You know, both trying something new while utilizing something from the past.
Waste not, Jamie. Waste not, want not.
Correct.
It's a lesson I'm trying to instill in my young child.
How's that going?
Well, we're getting there. But yeah, just like trying to, without using the S word, try to convey to him my firm belief that waste is a sin. Especially now in the holish hellscape of 2022. that, you know, like throwing food out just because you didn't finish it is, you know, very much sinful and disrespectful to everybody who's fucking suffering and not lucky the way that we are.
And likewise, not making wine from old vines, in my opinion, is quite sinful. When these vineyards were originally planted, they were farmed using, you know, farming methods back then. Just going out there and picking the grapes and making sure that the vines are alive. And the reason that they got abandoned was that modern technology, what we now call conventional agriculture, couldn't really be applied to them because they're difficult vines to work. And now we're back to a point where we're assigning, you know, the name biodynamics or organics. And this particular vineyard is farmed biodynamically in a way, you know, using cover crops to avoid erosion because the granite topsoil is very, very shallow and super, super valuable. You know, going in there and picking by hand each time and making sure that you're using integrated pest management. So taking some of the more mystical ideas of biodynamics and its lunar calendar and fruit days and root days and all of that and applying a little bit more science to it.
All right, Jamie, that all sounds great, but you know what I'm going to say. Talk to me about flavor. How I feel like we do this a lot with modern techniques, but what are the modern conceptions of classical ideas? How are they represented in the glass here that I'm going to refill, which is probably inadvisable?
Go ahead and refill that glass. You've got my permission. You're going to be fine. So as far as transferring flavor, I think it's expressed in the extreme ripeness of this wine. In all of the ways that we've described it, and then in some of the ways that we haven't described it, right? This is once again a very clean wine. It went into a winery that was sanitized, and there was thought put into making sure that the fermentation went smoothly and cleanly. In addition to having a wine that is sort of high octane, we also have one that's perfectly clean.
Hang on, I'm trying to detect the high octane.
High octane gasoline.
Mm. It's a weird one, Jamie. This one's a weird one.
I really like it. I really like it a lot. And we didn't even talk about the little bit of residual sugar here. There is some sugar here.
There is some sugar here. There's some sweetness, which I appreciate. I appreciate you taking my notes. You definitely did this because I wanted it and not because you don't give a shit and you do whatever you want. But I appreciate it. I like having some sweetness.
Spoilers, the next wine also has some sweetness.
Mm. Well, I'm looking forward to that one very much then.
Actually, a little bit more sweetness than this one does. But I think the sweetness does a lot to balance this wine out. You know, it doesn't have extreme acid that requires sugar to balance it, but it does have a lot of texture and bitterness. And the sweetness really helps ease that on the palate.
It offsets it, right? Like we talked about this recently, the like chronological trajectory of a wine, right? Like the, what do you call it? Is it the start to the finish or the open to the finish?
You mean on your palette?
Yeah, on the palette, yes.
Yeah, the front palette to the back palette, the beginning to the finish. Yeah.
But yeah, this one is like, it hits you first, I think, with a lot of the bitterness and the texture, but then that sugar kind of brings itself out in the middle. And then I was getting that spice, that cardamom thing in the back of the throat towards the end. But yeah, without all that residual sugar in the middle, it would just be a lot of what I would describe as unpleasant notes.
Yeah, I agree with you. If there wasn't a little bit of sugar, this one would be a tough needle to thread, and I probably wouldn't enjoy it very much unless maybe there was like a hyper-specific food pairing.
Okay, well, I mean, we haven't done this in a while, but what would you pair? Because this feels more, this doesn't feel like what you call a cocktail wine, right? This is a no, gastro this is wine.
Definitely gastronomic wine. A classic pair for Alsatian whites is like the sausages and beans of the area. Dishes like choucroute, garni, and cassoulet go really, really well.
Yo, that sounds great. I want some sausages now. Some sausages with the rest of this bottle.
A little bit of sauerkraut?
No, I'm not really on board with sauerkraut, but maybe.
You don't like sauerkraut?
Jamie, you've known me 25 fucking years, all right?
Yeah, but you don't like sauerkraut?
I don't like sauerkraut. I've never liked sauerkraut. Jamie, we have spent the last 15 months talking extensively and regularly about the things that I don't like in flavor. Take all of those conversations and then imagine sauerkraut. What fucking world do we live in where I would enjoy sauerkraut?
I don't know. A world where you're a sane thinking person who likes good things.
Sauerkraut is not one of these universal truths, Jamie, okay? It's not like a crisp apple autumn day. No, it's not.
The universal truth of sauerkraut will live on.
Nothing that smells that bad is universally appealing on the palate. Like, so sorry, delicious. Nothing is universally appealing, but sauerkraut, this is a line in the sand, Jamie. I'm drawing it. This is not a reasonable stance that you're taking. Like, is this a bit, or do you actually think that everyone should love sauerkraut?
I don't care if it's reasonable. If you're out there in listener podland and you don't like sauerkraut, you can go f*** yourself.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. You heard it right here. Sauerkraut's delicious. Take its name out your mouth.
I guess I can go f*** myself, Jamie, and you can finish this show by yourself with your disgusting bowl of pickled cabbage.
No, I need you. We're about to get into the movie section.
Yeah, goddamn right. Jamie will just tell you what he liked about the movie a bunch of times.
I mean, I could do that, but it would get really repetitive.
I mean, I could too. I just have more interesting things that I like than what you like.
Go f*** yourself. Sauerkraut hating son of a bitch.
It's gross. It's gross. It's weird. I just don't understand. Why are you surprised by this?
I shouldn't be, but it's one of those things that I consider to be just so superlatively delicious that whenever someone tells me they don't like it, I immediately forget that fact because I want to continue liking that person.
All right. Well, Jamie, so this is Grapefruit Part 2, the sequel, the Lega sequel. Grapefruit comes back from retirement after 20 years of dormancy because the IP is suddenly ripe for the zeitgeistical pornographic nostalgia cycle, and Grapefruit has to pass off the torch to Sauerkraut, played by Jeremy Renner or some shit.
Can we move on?
Yeah, please do. This is a great post-credits tangent for the poor bastards who actually, you know, can't find the stop button when the music is over and have to listen to all the shit that I put after the credits.
You poor guys.
It's okay. All right, so Jamie, let's tie it up here. Connect this to the two that we drank before, but you have to remember that as this miniseries goes along, you have more and more wines to connect these two.
Right.
So like you've already tied this in like narratively, but like can you just start with flavor? Like can you compare this to the previous two wines that we drank in this Pinot Gris / Gris miniseries?
For sure. I mean, we've transitioned from Italian styled Pinot Grigio into French styled Pinot Gris. And the conversation around French Pinot Gris really, in the 21st century anyway, begins and ends in Alsace. Pinot Gris was historically grown in Burgundy, but I'm not even going to tell the story of it being expelled from Burgundy. We can do that another time.
Is this a dumb thing about French people?
A guy named Philip the Bold in the 15th century
issued
a proclamation that all vines other than Pinot Noir and Chardonnay be ripped out in Burgundy.
Because
he thought Pinot Noir and Chardonnay were the only good grapes to grow in that area. And that has endured for 6 centuries.
You know, the whole like romantic notion of like being an American expat living in France and dining and having the delicious foods and the Parisian cafes and living in an old world lifestyle so divorced from our, you know, rushed and busy and stainless steel American lives. I'm losing the thread here. But that all sounds like so appealing to me until I remember that there are so many goddamn stupid fucking moron laws from centuries ago that are just about punishing people because one asshole didn't like wine or, again, thought that UFOs were going to take his grapes or some shit.
Yep, correct.
Ah!
It's a nice reminder, though, that, like, we have that romantic vision of a European lifestyle. It's a nice reminder that they are or were just as stupid as we are.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Their Nazis have been coming back way longer than ours have.
I am not even going to touch that one.
Please move along.
Let's go right back into, you know, this wine in conversation with the other two that we've drunk. You know, yeah. The other two did not achieve these levels of ripeness. The Schioppetto certainly had a touch of botrytis to it, but definitely not at the level that this one does. This is the first time that we're dealing with residual sugar. This is the first time we're north of 14% alcohol. I think stylistically, we're talking about something completely different. This is what has been canonized as the French style of Pinot Gris from a flavor perspective. And then from a more like meta-textual perspective, I drew the parallel earlier that, you know, this is now the third story of second or third generation winemaking families that were able to purchase wine in the middle of the 20th century while land was cheap. That is not possible these days. All this land is very extremely valuable. That's the thing that draws them together, along with this grape being also the same grape that they used.
We're halfway through the miniseries now in terms of the Pinot Gris side of it. Where is this taking us to next? Where we're preview for them what flavors and wine minutia we are to see next.
So the next three wines are all American wines, and they're all three very unique takes on the grape. The next one is going to be one that is very much in conversation with this Alsatian style. The one after that is very much its own thing that has become a benchmark style of the world. And the third one is much, much more modern, much, much more unusual, but I think will become more commonplace.
Alrighty. And most importantly, am I going to like the next three wines?
I think for sure. Yeah. No, I think with some certainty, you are going to like all three of them. The sixth and final one might be the one that I'm least sure of, but I still think you're going to like it.
All right. I'm casting doubt, Jamie. I'm casting doubt.
Go on ahead and cast that doubt.
Oh, I shall.
We've talked about this wine, I think, a bunch, and in quite rambling form, as we tend to do. Some of the things we talked about were reimagining abandoned places, young winemaker working with old vines, and the modern concept of the classical. These were things that I talked to you about prior to, you know, deciding on this miniseries. Why did you bring us to the idea of Lega sequels?
Well, because all of those things scream Lega sequels to me. Reimagining abandoned places, taking a franchise or an IP or just a single movie, taking something that's been long dormant and doing it again. A young winemaker and old vines. Most of these Lega sequels and Resurrections is one of the rare exceptions. They're not the original filmmakers returning to something that they made 20 or 30 or 40 years before. Like the cast is usually coming back. But it's new filmmakers, oftentimes people who grew up with those old movies, reimagining them in a sequel that oftentimes is a remake and a meta commentary on the actual idea of the first movie. Modern concept of the classical. Like, I don't even need to unpack that. You know, they're trying to modernize and drag fucking Jurassic Park and Blade Runner. Yeah. And I don't know, the fucking Goonies, I'm sure, is going to be one eventually.
Yeah, that one's pretty on the nose.
I'm just kind of shocked, right, that it hasn't happened yet. I should start by just like, you had not heard the term legacy gold prior to this, right? This is like kind of...
No, I had not, although when you say it out loud or see it written down, it is pretty intuitive.
It's a pretty good portmanteau, isn't it, Jamie?
It is, yes.
Yeah. So legacy gold is a term coined by film critic Matt Singer, who writes for and is, I believe, the editor-in-chief of ScreenCrush.com. Matt has been a critic that I followed forever. He's like one of the funniest people writing about movies on the regular. I'm sure, Jamie, I have shared these with you before. Matt Singer is the guy who writes the articles where he, whenever there's like a restaurant with a movie themed like menu tie-in for a big blockbuster, he will go and just sit down and eat the entire thing in one sitting and then come up with a bunch of terrific jokes about all of the food and parallels and try. He's basically doing a jokey, very, 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 very high calorie and cholesterol version of what we're doing here.
Yes.
We'll have to share some of those. He most recently did one for the calzone. The calzone is so funny. But yeah, the Little Caesars semi bat shaped calzone / pizza, hellish crossbreed tied into the new Matt Reeves, Robert Pattinson, The Batman in theaters exclusively March 4th. But yeah, Matt is terrific and he's a blast. But he wrote a piece back in 2014 leading up to the release of The Force Awakens, talking about legacy sequels, and he coins this term legacy sequels, which is kind of like blown up in movie criticism circles. It seems like the default that everybody goes to now. And Matt said that this very specific kind of sequel in which beloved aging stars reprise classic roles and pass the torch to younger successors. He also elaborates that like a legacy sequel like will address the passage of time between installments, and that it also will often have the new generation, the one that is receiving the passed torch, can often serve as like an audience avatar or a fan. So the first example that he cites, and I can't think of anything earlier, is 2008's Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which introduces... Yeah, I know. You know what, though? Here's me giving a hot take. That movie is not all that much worse than Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And now...
That is a hot take, my friend.
A lot of people just turn the episode off, and that's okay. That's fine.
Yeah, I'm hearing the stop button.
Yeah, from you're just all hearing our world. Analytics crash, basically. Well, whatever, okay? Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade has amazing chemistry between Ford and Connery, and everything else in that movie is just like a pale imitation of Raiders. I digress. But like Crystal Skull, we have old, I don't know, late 60s Indiana Jones, and we introduce everyone's favorite new character, Mutt Williams, played by Shia LaBeouf, as the new one, the son who is going to come in and inherit the hat and the legacy, right? Which, of course, never fucking happened. Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams 2009 Star Trek reboot, which is sort of a legacy sequel, but it's also there's a specific subsection of legacy sequel, which is the legacy sequel / reboot. Star Trek 09 is a reboot of the old school Star Trek canon, but that still, through a convoluted kind of bullshit time travel mechanic, folds the old canon into it and allows both to exist, but has old Spock in the movie, like passing the torch to new Spock and the new crew.
You know, I've seen that movie. I know I've seen that movie.
Yeah.
I remember almost nothing about it.
I mean, this is just Scott having hot takes about popular things that, you know, no one cares about. But I'm like a hardcore Star Trek person, or at least I was as a child and a young person. And that movie drives me fucking crazy, mostly for all the ways in which it's really just about how much J.J. Abrams loves Star Wars. And Star Trek was like an excuse to put all that on screen. But yeah, the trend continues. Tron Legacy is like a really, really big example of the legacy sequel. It has Jeff Bridges coming back. It does something that happens a lot in the legacy sequels where there's like a CGI digitally de-aged Jeff Bridges and there's a new character who's the audience surrogate, and it follows largely the beats of the original Tron. Ryan Coogler's Creed is probably the best example of a legacy sequel in that like it is straight up a sequel to the old Rocky movies. It has a new character coming in, the passage of the torch, but it's very organic and it's like a real movie and doesn't feel like fucking IP in like a really tortured way.
I never saw it. You like?
Yo, Creed is awesome, Jamie. Creed is so good. God, I cried so hard in Creed when we saw that in theaters.
Do you know offhand if it's available on any stream?
I do not, but you should just watch it because it's God, Creed is outstanding. Michael B. Jordan is so good in that movie. Oh, I'm getting chills, man. Creed.
I dig it when you get that response from a thing.
Creed is real special. You have to watch it, and then we have to talk about the moment that made me cry, because I won't dare give it away, but it's real good. The 2011 Muppets, the Jason Segel-like Muppets reboot, is 100% a Lego sequel.
Which
right?
makes me cry every single time.
That movie's so good. I don't know if I'm
a Muppet or a man.
Oh, Muppet or a Man? God, that's a fucking karaoke jam for me if I ever got to do karaoke again. And then other examples are there's the 2018, the David Gordon Green Halloween remake, which is just called Halloween. That's another thing with Lego sequels, is that they function sort of as reboots for the audience, and they just take the name of the original and offer nothing to distinguish it. The last two Scream movies are both Lego sequels, Scream 4 and 2022's Scream.
When did Scream 4 come out?
2010, 2011, I want to say.
Not even conscious of these things.
It's okay. You don't need to be, Jamie. That's what we're here for.
Did you see the fifth one?
You know what, Jamie? I've never seen any of the Scream movies.
Huh.
Like none of them. That's just like a huge blind spot for me. I feel like I will have to go and watch them. The last two Terminator movies have both functioned as Lego sequels, and of course, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be mean about it, because a lot of people who listen to the show really like this movie. But with no value judgment implicit, 2021's Ghostbusters Afterlife is, by all accounts, explicitly a Lego sequel. I have not, and if the fates allow, will never watch that movie.
Yeah, it doesn't look like one that I am interested in seeing at all.
Well, it's just like a sequel to Ghostbusters decades later. But what if... sweet and sincere and nostalgic and loving.
And not funny.
And not Ghostbusters. But yeah, that's not happening. I'm not watching that. But so the two big offenders for me, and I say offenders because I find the trend of Lego sequels to be largely, like, not only is it pervasive now, but I'm finding it very annoying because of my disdainful feelings about, like, corporatized, weaponized nostalgia. But the two biggest examples for me, and by far the most popular examples, are Star Wars The Force Awakens and Jurassic World.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Force Awakens I have seen, Jurassic World I have not.
How did the Lego sequel element of The Force Awakens strike you?
Nothing struck me about The Force Awakens.
Really?
Honest to God, I think I've only seen it once, but I remember thinking it was just kind of a dial tone. There really wasn't anything going on, and there certainly wasn't anything interesting being said.
Wow. Wow. I never thought I would find someone who was less affected by The Force Awakens than I was, but then here you are. Here's Jamie. That's wonderful.
I disengaged with Star Wars, as you know, and my other friend Scott, Wine Scott, is a Star Wars fanboy. When I first met him in, I think it was 2015 or 2016, he already had a Kylo Ren vanity plate on his car.
What does it say? Is it just like it's he just got Kylo Ren? I guess that's seven digits. It just says Kylo Ren. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was way the fuck into it.
It's like people naming their kid Khaleesi and then being shocked when she turns out to be a fucking mass murderer at the end of Game of Thrones. Oops.
And I'll preface all of this by saying that I really do love Wine Scott. He's one of my favorite people. But he, like, from the moment we met and became close friends, was badgering me to watch The Force Awakens. And I was very much like, nope, I'm done with Star Wars. I've had my heart broken enough times. I don't want to go back. And then he pulled exactly the same move that you pulled with The Last Jedi, which is to buy me the Blu-ray.
I didn't buy you the Blu-ray.
Yeah, you did.
No, I didn't.
Why do I have a Blu-ray?
I browbeat you into watching the movie, and you watched it. And then, after I bought the 4K for myself, I gave you my old Blu-ray.
Whatever. You didn't buy it specifically for me, but you gave me the Blu-ray.
That is correct.
He's a semantic son of a bitch.
It's not the same. It's not the same card, Jamie. He bought it for you to lower your barrier to entry. I just talked you into watching The Last Jedi.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And one of the Scots, I'm not going to say is correct or not, but definitely has a better read on Jamie's sensibility.
That is for sure.
Right.
So I watched The Force Awakens, and I was just bored and completely, as you said, disaffected by it. Like the scene in Adaptation where Meryl Streep and Chris Cooper are on the phone trying to make a dial tone.
Yeah.
That's what the fuck was going on in my head when I was watching this movie.
Can I just tangent really quickly?
Yes.
So in the Adam McKay fucking obnoxious climate change allegory, Don't Look Up, that's currently on Netflix, and that is...
Oh, good. I'm glad we're getting into this one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's probably going to win fucking Best Picture, and I want to vomit all over myself because there's no hope for art. But Meryl plays a very... esque president named President Orlean, and one of the only things that entertained me about the movie was trying to reconcile the head canon that she was playing real world author Susan Orlean, the character that Meryl played in adaptation. And you cannot reconcile those two things, but it was either that or pay attention to a movie that was rolling up a newspaper and smacking me on the nose over and over again, and I play the headcanon game instead.
I think that that's fair and good for your mental health.
It was the right choice.
So yeah, I watched The Force Awakens. I was bored. Scott was very upset with me that I thought it was a dial tone. And then it took, I think, extra long because of that for you to then convince me that Last Jedi was worth a damn.
Yeah,
which it is. Because I was so profoundly bored by Force Awakens.
Yeah. I think you're being maybe like a little bit harsh on it. Like, I'm extremely lukewarm on The Force Awakens, but like, you can't deny the casting. The casting is terrific. It has a great energy. There's a lot of fun. There are some good set pieces in it. The music, like, you know, John Williams is still doing the work. There's fun and there's a good time to be had in The Force Awakens. But the dial tone that you're talking about for me is just that, like, you know, Star Wars, for being like a very simple children's film version of a hero's journey and about finding a connection to a larger world and these, like, you know, very basic themes about spirituality and engagement with yourself and family and legacy. Like, Star Wars is about something, and The Force Awakens is just like this gee whiz thing about, like, man, didn't you guys miss Star Wars? You can just, like, imagine J.J. Abrams, like, sitting in the theater next to you and just elbowing you. He's like, hey, look, it's an X-Wing.
Remember Chewbacca? Member Luke?
The movie, it's just fucking member berries. Like, South Park is harder and harder for me to, like, think about and give credit for anything. But, like, man, member berries just nailed it on the fucking head with that. And Jurassic World is the exact same thing. Jurassic World is, like, has no ideas whatsoever. It's just like, boy, Jurassic Park is so great. What if we just made Jurassic Park again, but then we, you know, didn't have the unbelievable, like, unprecedented, you know, filmmaking skills of Steven Spielberg to make that movie magic, is what it is. Like, what if we just threw a bunch of CGI dinosaur bullshit up on the screen and audiences would love it? But Jamie, they fucking did. Like, both of those are, like, I think they're both still in the top 10, like, biggest movies of all time. And this is, for me, like, why the Lego sequel is a problem, because the ones that people latch onto and love, it feels like they're the ones that have nothing to say except, remember the Jurassic Park theme? Remember X-Wings? Remember Death Stars? We've got another Death Star now. And I just, like, I need more meat on them bones, man. Like, part of what I love about Resurrection so much is that it's, like, it's everything that I want in a movie. Like, I'm a fucking basic. Like, if I were to be happiest, it would be to watch... like, to sit down and watch a movie that's a big, like, genre spectacle filled movie, but that has humanity and has themes and has ideas, you know? Like, I'm always so excited when I walk out of, like, one of these big summer event films and I get to say, like, oh shit, they made a movie. That wasn't product. That wasn't what film critic Matt Sollersites describes as movie flavored product.
Movie flavored product.
It's good, right? He's real good. There's a reason he's a professional writer and I'm talking into a microphone in my bedroom. With the Lego sequels, I've left a few out of my list of them because there have been a few that I found extremely compelling that have kind of engaged in a dialogue with the other Lego sequels and with this trend of nostalgia for old stories and old movies and old IP. The first and most obvious example, we've already talked about it, is Rian Johnson's Star Wars The Last Jedi, right?
Fucking love this movie.
You look at the trilogy, the Star Wars sequel trilogy, and The Force Awakens is... I should give The Force Awakens credit. It has one idea in it. There's one idea in the whole movie.
Which is?
Which is that, like, just because you defeat the guy at the top doesn't mean that Nazis go away.
Okay.
That movie came out in December of 2015, and, like, JJ maybe was accidentally onto something, but there is a real kernel of truth in that movie that, like, yeah, fascists don't go away just because you kill the guy at the top. There's always going to be assholes who want to put their boot on your face. The Force Awakens largely is just about how much we love Star Wars. And then The Last Jedi is, like, this reminder of our roots. And it tells us to, like, disregard notions of inherited bloodlines that the prequels and that especially Force Awakens seem to be so obsessed with. And it says to look deeper than the plastic toyetic elements. You know, we talked about this last time. The Ryan has that scene in the movie that reminds us about what the Force is, that it's spiritual and it's not just about having superpowers. And the movie, and this is the thing that I really key into talking about the nostalgia cycle, is that The Last Jedi is a movie that is like searching for a reasonable middle ground between what Kylo Ren says, let the past die, and between the Luke status quo at the beginning of the movie, which is being a broken, sad old fucker who is so defined by his past mistakes that he's stuck repeating his mentor and his mentor's mentor's failures.
Yeah. So speaking of his mentor's mentor, you know, you were talking about that, the scene in the movie where Luke is teaching Rey what the Force is. Is that not kind of like a sister scene with the destruction of the Jedi texts that happens later by Yoda's hand?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Yeah, because Luke is obsessed with these old tomes, right? These reverent old tomes, these fucking dusty old books that he's holding as being so important. And Yoda is like, page turners, they are not, you know, like it's you got to let some of this shit go, man. Like a sacred text is a problem. We shouldn't have sacred texts. We should be able to interrogate and move on from our texts
and keep learning and keep growing.
And then, of course, like Jamie, I mean, I warned you and I told you not to, but you watched The Rise of Skywalker anyway. And so now you know that The Rise of Skywalker concludes the trilogy by being a movie that is like, Star Wars is still really great. And also, fuck you, The Last Jedi.
Oh, God, I cannot describe to you my ire.
Well, you know,
that movie makes me mad.
You were warned. You were warned,
Jamie. I was
warned.
I have no one to blame but myself.
You were warned. I blame you as well. But that's just one of them. That's just one of the LEGO sequels that is more interested in interrogating the idea. You, I'm going to guess, have not seen Blade Runner 2049, right?
I have not.
Blade Runner 2049 rules. Fantastic movie. So much better than the 1982 original Blade Runner directed by Ridley Scott. 2049 is directed by Denis Villeneuve, who has now gone on to great fame and accolade, making a big internal kind of cold sci-fi movie in Dune that like people actually liked. Blade Runner was a huge flop. But that's a movie where, by the way, spoilers for Blade Runner 2049, if you haven't seen it, which most of you haven't because people didn't watch that movie. But it's a movie where it basically like has your main character who is looking for meaning in memories of his childhood and his memories of like childhood heroes. But that he finds out that is really just chasing other people's dreams and that it will ultimately leave you empty and unfulfilled and completely listless in your life.
I that's a good theme to explore. I like that.
I think so. And it does it through the Gaz. I'm a big fan of the Gaz in that movie. He plays a real good robot.
We love a human playing a robot.
Oh, I mean, we don't normally have any other option, Jamie.
It's true. Although, you know, eventually maybe we can. Maybe we can have robots playing robots.
Or robots playing humans, which we're already doing now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the last of the interrogative. The last of the interrogative LEGO sequels that I want to talk on before we get to Resurrections is Watchmen, the Damon Lindelof produced and written 2018 Watchmen series for HBO. You have just recently watched that.
Sure did.
It was a surprise LEGO sequel because you wouldn't know, but like all of the marketing leading up to it, Lindelof was saying that we're not doing a remake. We're not adapting the story. We are doing a remix on Watchmen. We're taking some of the themes and the iconography and we're doing our own spin on it. And by the second or third episode, it was abundantly clear that that was all a smokescreen and that it was straight up a sequel to the book.
Right.
Not to the 2007 Zack Snyder movie, but to the like 1986 fucking sacred text of comic books, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons's Watchmen. But one of the many, 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 many like rich and interesting and complicated themes in the HBO Watchmen is talking about nostalgia. That's a theme throughout the book.
Also, and not just a concept, but also a drug called nostalgia.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally a drug called nostalgia. The show, like not to put words in anybody's mouth, but like in the show, they pretty clearly tell us that nostalgia is not universal, that one person's nostalgia can be toxic to another, and that one person's nostalgia can bury another person's truth. All of these things coming together, I'm always interested in conversations between filmmakers happening through their films. Resurrections feels like not the period on the end of that sentence, but to me, it's the next stanza in or the next verse in this pushback on the nostalgic LEGO sequel trend that is just, for my money, like choking the life out of big budget studio filmmaking. Like everything is fucking dredging up old IP. And if it was IP that we made into a movie before, then we gotta hit the nostalgia button and, you know, get the dopamine pumping so that everybody's happy. They can see their old friends on screen. They're doing another goddamn Indiana Jones movie, Jamie. We've complained about this before, but like, just let it go. Let it go.
Let it the fuck go. But we're not talking about Indiana Jones, Scott. We're talking about The Matrix Resurrections. Yeah, a thing that I'm interested in that occurred to me as we're going through all of these legacy sequels, you know, you say that Resurrections isn't putting a period on the end of the sentence, and I agree with that. But it's certainly novel in one specific way among the canon of legacy sequel, right? And that's that it's made by one of the same people that made the originals.
That's correct. Yeah, it is the rarefied example in this where like the original creator has come back. And so the commentary of the Lego sequel is like, it's much more explicit. You know, it's much more interesting what Lana Wachowski has to say revisiting The Matrix than it is what fucking Colin Trevorrow has to say making Jurassic Park sequels.
Right. And it also has, I mean, Neo remains our protagonist.
Yeah, he doesn't like it. It's not like, for example, The Force Awakens, where like an older Neo, you know, shows up in the second act, essentially, after we've already established our new characters. Like he's your guy. He's your boy the whole time.
His point of view is so radically different in Resurrections from what it was in the other films.
It's something that Resurrections does that none of the others have done. And TV and culture and critic at large, Emily Vanderwerf, wrote a terrific piece about Resurrections not long after it came out. And she talked a little bit about the idea of these legacy sequels that keep bringing up these characters who, like, decades prior in their stories had achieved catharsis.
Right.
Right. Like Neo, even in death, achieved some kind of catharsis. He fulfilled some kind of destiny. He fulfilled his purpose and helped free the people of Zion, even though he died fighting Smith. By bringing it back, like Lana directly addresses, like, this is not a happy-go-lucky fucking adventure for Neo. Like, he gets jacked out and he's just like, Jesus Christ. Like, so you mean that everything that we did before was for nothing? You know, he is so broken and distressed to have to be in a Matrix movie again. Like, God damn it, guys, I fought so hard for this shit. You mean to tell me they plugged me back in again? I have to do this again? And then he's not interested. I find that really compelling. He's not really interested in fighting the machines. He just wants to save Trinity and the two of them. Like, when they get together, then he'll figure out what he wants to do. But like, for now, it's like, I'm not fighting you, Smith. I'm bored. I'm so bored. Like, just get the fuck out of my way.
Yeah, the Smith thing, the fighting the machines thing, that's all being on the treadmill for him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's more of the same, and you're right, he's not interested. And we've talked about this a little bit off mic, and I'm sure other people who are smarter than us have talked about how his fighting moves are even like just trying to dismiss conflict more than they are engaging in combat.
Yeah, his new, and the movie has a couple of versions of it, but like his new bullet time is purely defensive. It's just a deflective force field. He fights a little bit when he has to, but his major move is to deflect and to defend.
I found that really, that was one of the things that really hooked me in on my first watch, like his new power and seeing how he used it. And also like how Keanu's performance while he was using that power looked. He looks so exhausted.
He's got a good grimace, right? Keanu really does. He like, I have always loved Keanu. I've always defended Keanu. People like, it's funny, the whole Keanu-sance that's happened like in the post John Wick, like last 10 or so years has been really delightful, but also like, man, fuck you guys. Like Keanu's been great the whole time and y'all are only just noticing it now, now that he's become like a meme essentially. But yeah, he's really aged into a much more interesting performer. And just like, he was always a great physical actor and even his physicality is more interesting now that he's in his 50s. I find the depiction and this like evolution of Neo Thomas Anderson in this movie so much more interesting than the like the resurrections of a lot of these dormant characters in other legacy sequels. There are so few examples of them where like a character is brought back in a way that is compelling or that feels true to that character's previous incarnations. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's you're 20 years removed, right? People change in 20 years. And this is one of the, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of these legacy sequels, but of them, this is one of the few where your characters are are marked by that 20-year difference, or in the canon of the movie, it's 60 years.
I mean, just like to put Neo of Resurrections up against, for example, two Harrison Ford characters, like the Force Awakens Han Solo is so boring to me. So, like he's just Han Solo again, but with gray hair this time, essentially. And like in right. between the events of Return of the Jedi and the events of Force Awakens, like he had this whole like huge amount of lived history. Like he got together with Leia finally, and they had a kid, and they sent their kid off to the Jedi training school. And then the kid turned evil and killed everyone. And then their friend Luke, who was supposed to be training their friend, just disappeared and fucking peaced out. And he splits off with Leia and goes back to his old life. And all of that is super compelling. And it is entirely between the movies and in no way is conveyed in the text, like at all.
Kind of insane that in the performance or in the writing, there isn't even a doffing of the cap to the impact that that would have on a person.
Yeah. I mean, I think Ford is like genuinely doing better work in that than he has in quite a while. But yeah, it's still like it's whatever weight is there. It feels like it's in the performance and not on the page. And even then, he's still really just playing, you know, he's playing the scales, essentially. But then to compare that to like Harrison Ford coming back in Blade Runner 2049 as Deckard, like that character has weight on him. That character feels sort of akin to how Neo is in this movie. You got to watch 2049. Dude, it is like one of the best science fiction movies I've seen in recent memory.
All right. I'm fully sold. Blade Runner 2049 and Creed are officially on the list.
Oh yeah. You're going to love both of them. But so aside from the Neo of it all, like I think Lana Wachowski is doing a lot of very interesting things in the context of other legacy sequels. So like she's doing just the stuff that everybody else does, right? So like it takes place decades later. We're bringing back our old fan characters. It is largely a remake of the original Matrix, which is something that like kind of slides by people. Like for all the critiques that you saw of this movie, and there were plenty, and I guess some of them are legitimate. I totally have blinders for this fucking movie. I'm so in love with it. I forgive all of its flaws, which there aren't any of, by the way. This movie is just as much a remake of The Matrix as, for example, The Force Awakens is of Star Wars. Like it follows all the same beats. We start with Thomas Anderson unaware that he's in a prison and he's listless and he has this encounter with Trinity that begins to wake him up, and then Morpheus comes into his life and reveals the truth to him, and then he jacks out and they tell him this new truth and he starts
but
that to
does yeah I understand where you're going, where these structural points are mirrored.
Yeah.
But does that a remake make?
No, but that's what I'm saying. Like it is a remake in the sense that it is following the same narrative arc for the character.
Okay.
Like we hit all of the main major beats, but the difference is that like she's using those major beats and revisiting them to say something new. We're revisiting them with a character who is dramatically different. Again, we'll talk about it a lot next time when we talk about what we're going to talk about, but the Neo and the Trinity, or the Tom and the Tiffany of the next movie, like when they encounter again, it's not just going over old ground. Like they have an adult conversation and an adult meeting, and the years that they wear on them like makes those parallels that the movie is explicitly drawing so much more complicated and interesting than just remember going to the club and wearing leather and asking me what the Matrix is. Like it, you know, it's so much more complicated and resonant and satisfying than that.
It's interesting also that she uses like actual footage from the 99 Matrix to even more firmly plant those structural elements.
Yeah, and to draw explicit parallels and callbacks. How do you feel about those? Because it was pretty divisive whether or not people like the flashes of the old movies or not. I personally love them.
Well, listen, if you described them to me, said, what about a movie where, you know, we're doing flashbacks to the old movie in scenes where there are callbacks? I would probably say that that's a mistake.
Yeah. On paper, it does not sound like a good idea.
No, on paper, it sounds terrible. But in the context of the movie, I'm thinking, I think the most impactful one for me is the introduction of Jonathan Groff.
Billions of people living out their lives oblivious. That's a really good line. Did you write that one?
It plants you in what she's trying to do, like firmly, so that you're not questioning it. Right. I think there might, had there not been that flashback, because you have a new actor in a totally other role from like an agent or this like otherworldly threat that Hugo Weaving was. You might be thinking to yourself, is that Agent Smith? Could it be?
And then the reveal when he sees the Desert Eagle and picks it up and Mr. Anderson, like that would come out of left field. I think the flashes and the callbacks are more effective in the first half before Neo unplugs than they are in the second half.
I agree.
But they're so effective because they're so subjective, right? Like we don't get them for no reason. We get them because they're these memories that are coming back to Neo, these memories that the machines have repressed or that they've turned into a video game. They've turned into something to like, you know, continue to lie to him. They're never there for narrative purposes. You know, they're not really there for clarity. They're there for emotional clarity. They're there to color why he is reacting to everyone the way that he does, because he gets this glimpse. My favorite of them, I think the Groff one is the funniest and just delightful. But my favorite is when he meets Tiffany for the first time, and as she's leaving the coffee shop, and he watches her walk away, and she turns as she's looking in, or as she's leaving the door, and she looks back at him, and we get the flash of in Reloaded when Trinity is leaving Neo because they, you know, just got off the ship and they're back in Zion and they really just want to go and bone. But instead she's like, these people, your zealots, your worshipers, they need you. And she leaves and looks back at him. And like that one is so effective for me and just gets me every time. But yeah, they're not just there to hit the nostalgia button. They're not just there to be like, well, this character is this and this character is this. Like they ground you in his experience.
It's kind of wild how they do hit the nostalgia button. Like they absolutely, that feeling that you get from hearing Hugo Weaving just say the word billions, or from Trinity in her leather in the club.
Yeah.
That's a visceral emotional feeling for anyone that grew up with those movies. But you're right. They also are resonant specifically for Tom.
Yeah.
It takes a deft hand.
It really is.
I can see why people wouldn't like it. I think that they are wrong.
Yeah. You know that those weren't scripted either, the flashbacks, the little flashes?
Really?
Yeah, I read a really good interview with David Mitchell, who is the author of the novel Cloud Atlas and who also collaborated with Lana Wachowski on a little bit on Sense8 and is one of the three writers on this film. And Mitchell said that Lana told them, like, this is something we're going to do, but I don't really need to write any of them in. We're just going to feel it out in the edit. It was just something that she like intuitively would get to a place and be like, all right, so we need something here. Like what shot, what moment from the old movies do we plug in here just to show us what Tom is feeling or thinking?
That's really cool.
She's real good, man. I'm all in. Whatever she's doing, I will follow that woman's movies to the end of, I don't know, fucking movies or whatever.
We're talking about the old structural elements of the film and sort of grafting a new narrative onto it. And last episode, we talked about the modal and the line, why use old code? That's resonant for the rest of the movie, right? Because we're in a completely new matrix that was built by the analyst, not the architect. Because Neo is able to use old code to get himself out, but also in a figurative way, we're using these flashbacks as old code to awaken emotions, both in the audience and in Tom.
Yeah. And then the movie like directly and repeatedly like addresses the question to the audience. Why are we doing this? Why are the characters doing it? Why are the filmmakers doing it? Why are you watching it? Why do you want it? Why is there this insatiable appetite for the old? Here, I've got a little clip. So last time, a friend of the show, Ryan, who is a web applications developer and went to school for computer software engineering and design and mathematics, he helped me kind of crack some of the stuff about computer programming and code that kind of has some impact on the narrative of this movie. So here's Ryan live on tape delay, being a sweet boy.
So in my experience, old code that's working is worth its weight in gold. Old code that is working is worth its weight in gold because you know that it works. You know you're not going to have to worry about any bugs that you're going to have to squash. The team is – yeah, bugs. You know the team already knows how to work with it. So old code is robust code because it's already been through the paces. There's no like real surprises, and you can kind of tweak what you need to get the output you want, essentially. Old code's great. Old code is the code that you go on Stack Overflow. Stack Overflow being, for those that aren't aware, is just a collection of users that ask questions about programming, and more well-versed individuals post answers and commentary on that. You know, you go to that site and you copy and paste old code into your program because, again, you know that it's working. So I don't know why they're questioning why it's old code so much in that aspect, but in the aspect of why we're seeing Trinity kicking those police SWAT teams, but I don't know. I don't know what that signifies other than it's cool to see. Man, what does it signify? Why would they say old code?
He's great. I love him. He's terrific on mic. I don't know that he's aware just how good he is. He's super engaging and so good at explaining these things that would be
very, very
probably
charming.
Very fucking tedious if, you know, any number of other people tried to do it. But I think he's onto something, and he and I didn't really talk about it in our conversation, but like at a meta level, why use old code? It's what Ryan is saying. Like it's robust, right? That's why they keep going back to these stories, because if you want to give it to them generously, like, well, we keep making Star Wars because Star Wars works narratively and thematically, and there's a good story and there's a good framework, and the world is good for telling stories that resonate with people. And if you want to be less generous, which is the way that I view it, it's that, well, it made a fucking ton of money and continues to make money, so we're going to go back to a thing that just makes money. It's robust code. It's reliable.
Right. I think within the world, you know, his opinion of old code really speaks to the Merovingian and his use of older versions of the Matrix and their guard dogs or whatever. Those bits of old code still work, and why get rid of them?
God, that fucking scene is so weird and sticks out of the movie so strangely and really should grind the whole thing to a halt and stop it. But Leverett Wilson, like, goddamn, if that guy doesn't just like nail that ridiculous fucking monologue that he clearly delivered like in one day, not on the same set as everybody else, and just like started reaming and spouting, you know, beautiful French profanity about,
you ruined every suck my silky ass thing.
We used to have art and films were meaningful, and now we have face Zucker fuck.
It's so good. And I think also every other character just completely ignoring him.
Yeah. What, while the fight is going on.
And especially afterwards when he like makes his dash off and like has a threat to issue towards the end, everyone's just like, whatever. He's not even a thing.
Yeah. Oh man. We'll come back to that scene a couple episodes from now.
The other thing that I wanted to say about what Ryan had to say, you know, his question, I guess, is that why would they be talking about old code? And it's right there in the text of the movie. This new Matrix exploits humans in a different way than the old Matrix did. So the old Matrix code is not useful in getting as much energy from them.
Well, so here's the thing. We didn't really talk about it in our modal episode too much, but like just in terms of literal narrative, It sounds like you think that the code that Tom made the modal from is from old Matrix code. Is that correct?
That seems to be the consensus on the screen.
Right. So that, and again, like we're talking about the Matrix, something that is like deep with metaphor and multiple meanings, and, you know, they're basically all dreaming, so it can follow dream logic and that's okay. But like, I don't want to be that guy, but like literally narratively, that doesn't make any sense. How, like, Tom made the modal. How would Tom get old Matrix code?
Now that I'm thinking about it, it's different. It's old video game code. It's
old video game code. This is my like dumbest, like, I guess it's a fan theory or whatever, but like, this is my dumbest and most favorite like textual reading of the movie, is that the modal is built using like some abandoned piece of code, either from an earlier version of Binary, the game that Tom's company is developing, or code from the original Matrix trilogy. And if that is true, and this doesn't actually matter for a reading of the movie, but it tickles me. If that is true, then the Morpheus and the Trinity that he puts into the modal are actually the characters that were in the video game.
Yep.
So the Morpheus that self-actualizes and is liberated from the modal, and then who helps liberate Tom, is actually like a video game sprite. Like, he's the avatar, you know, he's a character from, I don't know, like a PlayStation 3 game who's been on the treadmill so many times that he evolved to be like a PS7 game character. And now he's escaped as a fully fledged digital sentience.
I like that fan theory.
Yeah, it's useless, but it is fun. And I think it's just an extra like nice bit of textual complexity. The other thing about what the movie is talking about, I think, with the Lego sequels and the context of Lego sequels is the idea of like nostalgia without nostalgia for the substance, right? Nostalgia that's just for the plastic elements. We'll get into it more next time, but a lot of the things in the White Rabbit montage, especially the stuff in the boardroom with Tom and the other people at the game developer, and they're talking about, like, what does the Matrix mean to everybody? And so much of what they're drilling down on is, like, they're all missing the substance. They're talking about bullet time. They're talking about carnage. They're talking about violence and leather and cyberpunk.
Getting up in your WTF pink space.
This is, like, again, the callback to, or the parallel to the Last Jedi scene where Luke is kind of like regrounding Rey and the audience and what the actual substance of it is supposed to be about. I don't know that Lana Wachowski necessarily has like a beef with nostalgia, but I think she's definitely trying to like reclaim these movies and remind us what it's really about. And she doesn't mind being like explicit and blunt about it. All the talk about the popcorn movies in conversation with other popcorn movies and all this like meta shit and movies in conversation with each other, like that can be very alienating to people. I know a lot of people and some reviewers who even said that they were just like turned off at the big jaw dropper moment for me when Groff says, you know, our parent company, Warner Brothers, is going to do a sequel to the trilogy and they're doing it with or without us. Like that alienated a lot of people. And I totally get it. I get that the meta stuff can be obnoxious and really in your face and is not what people signed up for. But to that, I counter, like, our entire fucking culture right now is just about resurrecting these, like, these corpses, these fucking dead things from people's childhood or from your parents' childhood that, you know, 20 years and 20 years of nostalgia cycles means that it's part of everybody's culture. I don't think it's fair to turn your nose up or be turned off by a very explicit, blunt, meta-textual element that is, like, running throughout this movie when all of our pop culture is just doing the exact same thing. At least she's talking about it, you know?
Yeah.
Fucking like the latest non-controversy, the big thing people are arguing about is in spoilers for the fucking Book of Boba Fett. But in two episodes of the Book of Boba Fett show, Luke Skywalker shows up once again after his weird digitally de-aged deep fake mocap. Hamill apparently may or may not have been involved at all. Like there's a deep fake element. There may have been a mocap, but the voice seems as though it was run by an algorithm that they just fed it like vocal samples of Hamill from the time period. And then they basically like typed in the dialogue and like had the algorithm come up with a way that it pronounces it. And he sounds like a fucking dead robot. He doesn't sound like a real person at all. Like, I just don't understand. That's a tangent. Just say like all of the culture that people are consuming in great fucking quantities, whether it's more and more Star Wars than ever existed before, or the Marvels or Ghostbusters Afterlife or yet another Jurassic World sequel, like, all of this shit that people are consuming and lapping up and loving it because it's returning to their childhood. Like these things are also meta in a way, but in a very shallow way where they're just, it's just member. It's, I liked this before and therefore it's the Morpheus line. We've said it a couple of times now.
Nothing calms anxiety like a little nostalgia.
Exactly. So like, I think it's valuable and important to have a filmmaker revisiting her own works and saying, but why? And also not a good idea. You shouldn't want more of this. And if you want more of this, you're going to experience it the way that I want you to experience it. This is my story. I have ownership of it and it's meaningful to me and it should be meaningful to you as well. So I'm going to remind you of what's actually meaningful about it. And then we're just going to start knocking them down all the ways that it's like bullshit interpretations are harmful and empty and shallow and useless.
That was all incredibly well said. And I don't have any addendums. You fucking nailed it. Well done, Scotty.
Thank you. I have strong feelings about nostalgia in that it's bad and I hate it. And hopefully, we never have to talk about it on this show ever again.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about it on this show again.
Maybe this episode, when it gets out there into the world, will, you know, put an end to the what I think is a harmful and infantilizing trend of the Lego sequels. And maybe we just won't have to do that anymore.
I like your optimism, Scott. Which is not real optimism because I know that you think that it's going to continue and in fact get worse.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just waiting until we're done recording and I'll turn notifications back on my phone and I'll see that the Hollywood Reporter is announcing that I don't even know. It's fucking the
Goonies reboot.
I was going to make a joke about a Mighty Ducks Lego sequel, but that already happened. Like it's everything. It's fucking everything, Jamie.
But Scott, you remember the Mighty Ducks?
I mean, I do. I was never a sports movie kid. That probably doesn't surprise anyone.
There was something about those kids' sports movies that I enjoyed. I think it's always an underdog and it's always kids that shouldn't be great at playing sports. And there's always a fat kid on the team. Little Giants and The Sandlot and Angels in the Outfield and like all of those fucking, they all had a fat kid that ended up being like, okay at sports. And I found that hopeful because I was a fat kid and I had a lot of internalized shame about my body.
Well, I'm sorry.
Because society, Scott.
Well, I mean, you can say society, Jamie, but we both know you're talking at me. You're talking about me, too. You're pointing a finger at me. I helped externalize and internalize your bad feelings about your body.
You did call me fat a lot.
So many times. Oh, boy. It was. I think now they call it bullying. That was bullying.
That's, yes, correct.
Yeah. All right. I have a thing here. I have a thing. Are you ready?
What's your thing?
All right. So we don't have wife takes, but Tani did pose what I think is a pretty thoughtful discussion question. And this is more on your end than on mine. So I'm just going to throw it out there.
Sure.
So in the context of talking about Lego sequels, she's spelling Lego sequel wrong. I'm going to have to send her proper vocab guidelines for how we spell Lego sequel. it's for everyone at home. It's LEGACYQUEL, Lego sequel. Maybe not intuitive, but it makes more sense than any other version. Anyway, not important. So Tani asked Jamie, does this movie more closely resemble a vertical tasting, given that the movie is clearly in discussion with previous efforts by the same director, or a horizontal tasting, allowing the conceit that the director draws actors and whatnot from multiple pools of talent from various projects like Sense8, Speed Racer, etc., as a winemaker might harvest grapes from multiple vineyards?
Huh.
That is a very impressive sentence.
It sure is. And I was unaware that your wife knew the difference between a vertical and a horizontal tasting.
Well, we're definitely cutting that out of the episode.
Do you know what a vertical tasting and a horizontal tasting are?
Absolutely not. No.
For those viewers out there and for Scott, who might not know what these are, a vertical tasting would be a tasting of the same wine, the same cuvée from the same producer across multiple vintages. So if we were going to do a vertical tasting of the Domaine Chauffeet Pinot Gris, it would be the Tradition bottling from 2019, also from 18, 17, 16, etc.
Okay, that's vertical. And then would then a horizontal be like different wines from the same producer, but like they wouldn't be the Tradition, right? They would be other things. Correct. From the same vintner.
So it would be the Pinot Gris Tradition. It would be the Riesling Sommerberg, the Riesling Rangen, the Gewürztraminer. I forget what vineyard they do. It would be the all of the wines that they produced in a single vintage.
Well, what's your answer, Jamie? Is Matrix Resurrections a vertical tasting or a horizontal tasting? I have a very astute answer already, but I want to know what you think.
I think that if you watch the trilogy and then watch this, that is a vertical tasting.
Mm-hmm.
But the Matrix Resurrections alone would be more akin to a horizontal tasting. You're getting different elements of flavor from different places that are disparate. You got some of the Sense8 cast. You have the loss of Lily Wachowski in the creative process. You're getting different perspectives.
Is somebody hammering at your house?
Yeah, there's construction going on my street.
Okay, great. Cool. Nothing we can do about that.
Nope.
I see what you're saying. I don't think it has to be an either or. I think it's both. This is going back to the auteur theory from two episodes ago, but like if you watch the movie, considering it in the context of not only the trilogy and Lana Wachowski's body of work and also all of the other collaborators from various other pieces that she's worked on coming together in this one, I think it's both. I think it's a vertical tasting and a horizontal tasting. You have to view it in the context of all of her other films and specifically the other Matrix movies. But if you're looking at it like holistically, I think you also have to look at it in the context of all of the other people and recurring collaborators that she brings into it. I think it's a good question. She's pretty sharp.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah. I mean, when she's not just trying to, you know, show off and bust your balls a little bit here, she would probably be better hosting this show than, at the very least, you would. Probably better than I would, too.
Well, she's smarter and funnier than either of us.
That is very true. And she will like that. And that will offset you being incredulous that she knew what a horizontal and vertical tasting was. Well done, Jamie. Well recovered.
I usually do.
Yeah. All right. Let's bring it in. Let's stick the landing.
Let's land this plane. We're doing this mini series, but we've got to hit the pause button because there's an event that's going on that makes Scott upset, and we've got to do an episode on it.
It's the biggest night in Hollywood. it's the fucking Oscars again, everybody. It's the fucking Oscars. And I was telling Jamie a few weeks ago that I was trying to think of something different that we could do this year than repeating our Best Picture nominees, like round robin, talking about the 10 nominees this year and wines that Jamie could pair with them, because I just wanted to do different and I just wasn't feeling passionate or agitated about the Oscars, and that it wouldn't be fun for me to just get on mic and yell because I don't feel upset about anything. And then the goddamn nominations came out, and then I watched some of them that I really greatly dislike. And so fine, we're just doing the same thing. Come back next week. We're talking about the 10 Best Picture nominated movies. Jamie will talk about a bunch of wines to go along with them. But then back to our semi-regularly scheduled programming the following week. Jamie, tell me where Pinot Grigio is taking us in 2 weeks.
So after our Best Picture nominees, a-thon, a.k.a. Scotty Mad. We are continuing on our Pinot Gris journey. We're dealing with a winery that I've got a pretty big personal connection to. That's Red Newt Cellars in the Finger Lakes. We're taking their Pinot Gris single vineyard Curry Creek from 2013, a little back vintage wine, something with a little age. That is available winery direct. That's rednewtcellars.com for $28.
So this is direct from the vineyard?
Correct.
Can one get it anywhere else? Not that I want to take money away from them, but is it available anywhere else?
You could get current vintage other places.
Got
the
it.
Back vintage, the 2013, is only available winery direct.
Okay, cool. All right, well, going along with Red Newt Pinot Gris, Curry Creek 2013, we're continuing with this vertical dive into The Matrix Resurrections. And next week, we're specifically talking about the characters of Tom/Neo, Tiffany/Trinity, and Smith/Smith. / fucking Groff, who gives maybe one of my favorite performances in the entire movie. So come back next week for the Oscars and yelling and Jamie recommending a bunch of wines based on movies he hasn't seen. And then come back in 2 weeks for more Pinot Gris and for more Matrix.
Love it. Thank you everyone for joining us. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod.
Please.
Email us with any questions or concerns at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Tell your damn friends. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. Our social media presence is thanks to the fine work of Jamie Harrison Rubin. That's him right over yonder.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
We do promise.